Hello, and welcome to the Architectette podcast. I'm your host, Caitlin Brady. Architectette is a podcast that illuminates the lesser heard stories of women plus in architecture and related fields. I'm excited to welcome you to a very special episode of Architectette this week. We are sharing a conversation with my colleague, Shannon Dowling. Shannon is a principal at Air St. Gross, which if you haven't been listening, that is the firm that I work at. And Shannon is our in-house expert for all things education spaces. She has the data to prove that our spaces are well-designed, they will be functional, they will serve our students, and they will provide spaces that are above and beyond the learning spaces of the past. We want collaborative spaces where students can learn dynamically in many different formats, both in-person and hybrid. And Shannon is the person at our firm who has done a lot of this research that helps us make spaces that are intelligently designed, but also have a lot of heart in them and really serve the users. And I think that a lot of Air St. Gross people will join for this episode. So hello, it's so nice to have you here. Welcome to the podcast. I hope you enjoy it. So for people who aren't familiar with Shannon already, Shannon is an architect, educator, and higher education strategist. She recently completed a year-long fellowship with the Society for College and University Planning, SCUP, during which she studied the role that physical campus space plays in facilitating belonging for college students. Shannon was recognized with AIA Virginia's 2023 Award for Distinguished Achievement in recognition of her work, research, and service. On today's episode, we talk about Shannon's background as an educator and her roles as architect and space analyst. We explore collegiate DEI goals and the importance of designing spaces that enhance a sense of belonging. Next, we emphasize the economic benefits of retaining students through inclusive design and talk about some of the trade-offs. We also talk about a University of Washington precedent, how Shannon and her team measured belonging in residential and social spaces, and how they identified successes and also potentials for improvements. We end with Shannon's top design trends to embrace and those we should abandon. So if you're interested to learn more about Shannon and explore her work at the end of the episode, make sure to check out our show notes. You can also share this podcast with a friend and follow us on LinkedIn, Instagram, and subscribe to our newsletter for behind-the-scenes content. Enjoy the episode. Shannon, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Do you mind just giving a short introduction to folks that maybe aren't familiar with who you are and what you do for work?
Sure. So at work, I am a principal and learning environment strategist. I will also say that I am a female licensed architect, and I feel like that's important to say, especially in your show, because what, there's 17% of us. I identify as a first-generation student, a first-generation alum, a first-generation white-collar employee. I also identify as a professor because I taught for over a decade, even though I haven't taught in the last couple of years. And then I also tell people that I'm a mother, and not only am I a mother, but I'm a mother to my oldest son has keratoconus, which is a degenerative eye disease, which makes it hard to see distances or in certain lights. And my second child is dyslexic. So that's why this whole non-traditional student diversity issue is really important and powerful to me.
And had you always worked on education spaces, or how did you come to work in this realm?
I have pretty much worked on education spaces since the day I got out of undergraduate school. So that's been over 20 years.
And so recently, you were one of the SCUP fellows kind of focusing your research on education spaces through more of like a diversity lens, or a JEDI or DEI, which is justice, equity, diversity, and inclusion. So as people listen, they'll hear us kind of talk about JEDI or DEI. And the kind of the crux of which is that a lot of, especially in the last couple of years, higher education strategic planning efforts are emphasizing the importance of all of these JEDI initiatives. And they're focusing their goals on things like faculty growth, student enrollment, retention, academic programs, culture, and practice. But you are studying how all of these values are applied to physical space. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So 2016, 2017, 2018, as I was working on master planning projects and different facility planning projects, I kept seeing the words diversity, equity, and inclusion pop up in strategic plans. And I kept seeing ways to increase diversity on campus. It was, let's enroll more students of color. Let's hire more faculty of color. Let's do training for people. And whenever I looked at the metrics, nothing ever had anything to do with physical space. And at the time I was teaching, and I would have a lot of conversations with my students. I remember one student had literally just got off the plane from China the day before. It was her first day in the United States, and I was her welcome mat. I had a student that was older than me who told me that all of her kids had went to school and she was going back to school. Yeah, I had, you know, students that were hard of hearing or students that had different neurodiversities. And it just made me realize that, like, as a teacher, we only spend a couple of hours with these students every single day. But as designers, we are designing the physical space in which they're growing into the next version of themselves. And started making me think, what could the physical space actually do to enhance belonging? And that's what I wanted to research, because I felt like at the time there was a big void. I feel like the conversation has progressed since 2019. I think we took a big step in 2020. Mm-hmm. But that's how I came to this topic.
Mm-hmm. So you were kind of looking at it before it really became like a trending or like a popular thing that people were caring about.
Yeah. And to tell you a little secret, I actually submitted the fellowship proposal the year prior and got rejected. And then they called me up in 2020 and said, like, hey, can you resubmit this? So that was in March of 2020. And we all know what happened in, you know, March of 2020, right after I got this phone call. And then what happened in, you know, May, June, and that summer with the racial uprising. So it's almost like I came along at the right time.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I would say you were even early for this movement. You kind of saw that there was a problem, wanted to identify and research, but it took everyone else another year to kind of understand, like, oh, this is actually a topic worth researching.
Yeah. And it was, and as I was researching, I did notice I wasn't the first one by any means. There were other people that had touched this topic as well, but there's a void where it's something that we kind of talk about more and more now. People weren't asking these questions, you know, 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of what the problems are in terms of physical space, what different issues did you come across in your research in terms of what needs do students have that aren't really manifesting in physical space?
Let's start with some things that I saw that are good, that were already happening. We were already starting to talk about restrooms and what restrooms look like and how to have more gender-inclusive restrooms. We were already talking about more sustainable design in terms of social sustainability, economic sustainability. We were already talking about food pantries and closed closets and lactation spaces, nap pods, affinity spaces. Like, the conversation was happening. I don't think we had really labeled it yet. Mm-hmm. At the same time, many of our students were still sitting in very forward-facing classrooms that looked very monotonous. The students were very close together. The buildings were very siloed. No one really knew what was going on. We were in buildings that were named with very icky names after people that probably shouldn't be memorialized. The artwork that was hanging on the walls isn't something that everybody could relate to. And even landscaping. And to this day, landscaping on college campuses, it's very Eurocentric. And a lot of the buildings and the styles that were designing, they're very austere and they have very Christian undertones to them. So those are some of the things that are those spaces really welcoming students to campus, and what are they saying about who belongs there and who doesn't?
Mm-hmm. And do you think that that is just like the college style and that's what we've learned to appreciate, or is like the kind of the aesthetic of the college experience starting to change because of these things?
So I think that was a college style that started to happen back in the late 19th, early 20th century. People like Ralph Adams Cram and others were purposely representing styles of European monasteries because they wanted to project college as this image of something that's very austere and very rigid, right? And then we had like the factory style, the first industrial revolution and the second industrial revolution. And I think that we just never really thought about it. We never really thought, like, what are our buildings saying? It was more like, well, this is what a college campus looks like. And we weren't necessarily asking the questions of if what it looks like was saying the right things to the students that we wanted to attract.
Mm-hmm. It was this kind of like reputation or this ego.
Yeah.
And so you mentioned the questions we should be asking. So if now that we know that maybe what we had been doing isn't the right answer, what questions, who do we ask questions to? And then like, how do architects, designers, and planners kind of plan for and incorporate these DEI values in their designs and their plans?
Yeah. So the big thing that I learned, and I've talked about this before, is the first people I started asking questions to were the administrators, the staff, the faculty, and everyone just kind of looked at me and said, wow, we should really be talking about that, but we're not talking about that. Let me know what you find out. Then I decided to go straight to the students, right? It's the professor and me. And the students knew exactly what they wanted to see. They could tell me exactly what made them comfortable, what made them uncomfortable. And really across all diversities and levels of inclusion, students wanted the same basic things, right? They wanted to have their physiological needs met. They wanted to feel seen, and they wanted to have some autonomy over their space. And so I feel like as architects and designers, we often go into projects with very curated listening sessions when it comes to students. Like, we'll ask for the universities to let us meet with students, and it'll be a very curated group that's, you know, the Student Government Association or the leaders, and it'll be one listening session, and we sort of just check the box. Yeah, that's, we did it, right? And now I know at least I, Airsynchronous, and I think a lot of other places too, we're trying to get a lot more authentic about it. And how can we really reach out to our diverse population? We've learned that you can't just talk to people face to face during one time and think that's okay. Like, we have to reach out to people different ways. We should have an on-campus sessions. We should have virtual sessions. We should have some sort of way for people to talk to us asynchronously. We should check in with people multiple times so that we make sure that we're not misrepresenting anything. Did I get this right? You know, is this what you would like to see? Would this actually facilitate your needs? So I feel like as designers, we're becoming just more authentic in the ways that we engage, and we're getting better at really listening to the end users.
And that being said, when you hear the needs of spaces, is there kind of one design fits all? Or how are we kind of approaching making sure a space works for many people? Are there any elements that are important to include as a general basis?
I'm sure you've heard that saying, like, when you've met one autistic person, you've met one autistic person, or something like that. I feel like when we try to design for all, we're designing for no one. Mm-hmm. And I think that the way to design for all is to hand the choice over to the user by designing spaces that are adaptable and spaces that have variety in them. I mean, how many times have you walked into a classroom or a lab space and there's only one type of chair, or there's only one height table that you can sit at. And that's just not how our bodies work. And so how can we design with intention? And we can really recognize that people need different things at different stages of their lives, no matter, what their intersectional identity is.
Mm-hmm. And that's something that was a theme that came up in a previous episode with NAFA President Tigris Osborne, who was talking about she might need a specific type of chair, but someone else needs another chair. So it's like you need chairs that are different heights and different widths, and some with arms, some without arms. It's that power of choosing the option that works best for you in that space, I think, which makes it more welcoming to people, because they can say, like, oh, today's a day I want a chair with arms, or today I don't need a chair with arms. They can kind of find that option that works best for them.
Yeah. I was one of the jurors at EdSpaces for the Product Innovation Awards. And it was fascinating because the product that we ended up gravitating to that won the award was a simple test chair for students that had arms that moved up and down. And not only did they move up and down, but they clicked when they did that to let you know if you had any kind of auditory disorder the chair's now in the upright position, the arms are now in the upright position, the arms are now in the downright position. And just that simple move of taking a chair, giving it choice. There were some other things, like it could move around really well. It had a breathable, visible back on it. It had nice softness to the seat. But just that simple, like, ability to choose, I want one up, I want one down, I want them both down. And they were able to think about the auditory needs as well. It just felt so perfect for the time. It's the Chatty Chair by Kimball International, if you want to look it up.
We'll link that in the show notes. So the reason we have so many standardized items is because people think that it's a cost issue, right? Like, it's easier to buy 50 of the same identical chair rather than having some that have higher weight capacity or are wider or have arms, don't have arms. If someone from a school is listening to this right now and they're going, oh, I would love to do that, but we have such a limited budget, how do we make our spaces more inclusive? What are the items or the spaces that have the most impact of when those are designed with DEI values in mind? They greatly enhance a student's experience in university.
Okay, so I want to back up. So the first thing you talked about is return on investment. And I mm-hmm. would say that the biggest return on investment that a university can make is keeping a student in college. Because when that student drops out, then they have to spend money to attract another student. When they can retain that student and that student graduates, then there's potential donor dollars and stuff like that. So their retention rate increases. They get higher quality and more students. So it's mm-hmm. like if the ultimate goal is student success, then wouldn't you purchase the type of furniture that you needed to make student success happen? Like if you are thinking about like a $300 chair or a $500 chair at the risk of a $30,000 tuition, like mm-hmm. then you've got your value system wrong. With that said, I was thinking about this question. I feel like outdoor spaces are really important for some of the reasons that I said before. Like these are our first impressions. These are the spaces that welcome students on to campus. These are the spaces that connect our buildings, that connect campus to the surrounding communities. And it's really important to think about like, what is that layer between campus and community saying? Like, is it a big gate that's telling you to get out or don't come mm-hmm. in? Is it something that's saying like, it's not really secure on the other side, like whichever is the other side? And then when we think about our buildings, like, are there these large steps up to this grand door that not everybody can actually get into? You know, once again, what's the aesthetic of that building? Does mm-hmm. it feel porous and safe and welcoming? And then I feel like the other space that's really not thought of in terms of student success and then in terms of equity inclusion that we really need to think about is actually faculty and staff space. We often think about faculty and staff office space in terms of the faculty and staff needs. But once again, when we think about it in terms of student success and we think about the fact that in order for students to succeed, they have to build connections. And the more connections that you build in college, the more successful you are, the higher your likelihood of graduation is and the higher your likelihood of success after graduation is, then that interstitial space for students and faculty to interact and for students and staff to interact is really some of the most important spaces on campus. And you could really argue that that's the reason we're on the physical campus. So I think that we really kind of undervalue how we set up faculty offices, how we set up those faculty and student spaces and those interactions, and what can we do to really liven those spaces to get the return on investment that we want to see. Mm-hmm.
Have you seen any trends of, is it more powerful to locate faculty offices closer to the academic spaces or the classrooms, or if just make them welcoming wherever they are?
I think that you have to be able to find them and get to them. And I think you have to first off know that they exist. Mm-hmm. I'm sure you've heard me say this before. I was a first generation student. I didn't know that faculty offices were a thing. And I've seen that thread repeated from first generation students over the last 25 years. And so if we put them somewhere that students see them and students understand I can go there, then we're doing a service to students. A lot of times we end up putting them behind a door, down a hallway, you know, off a closed corridor. I say that it doesn't look much different. Like a hotel corridor and a faculty office corridor often look the same. With that said, I know that sometimes faculty go in their office to close the door and to get work done. And so then that makes me wonder if it's really this idea of palliative place, and maybe we need some spaces right outside the classrooms and right outside the instructional labs that faculty can kind of touch down in, that they can hold their office hours, that they can have spaces to connect with students before and after class. And then we need some other kind of removed quiet spaces where people can go to get heads down work done. And yeah, I think we see this trend in workplace too, but it makes me wonder if it's not really about this one single 120 square foot space.
Exactly. And so there is also a precedent that you've looked at. We were talking about this before the episode. Can you talk a little bit about UW and how the assessment that they did on their new res halls and what we learned from it?
Sure. So after I presented my SCUP project in 2022, Rob Lubin from Housing and Food Services at the University of Washington in Seattle came up to me and said, I've been waiting for something like this. Like, I really want to measure the progress of our residence halls and our food services. Do you want a proof of concept really for your playbook? And so we ended up doing a project together that actually just wrapped up last week. They had, I meant to look this up and I forgot, I don't know, 10 or 12 new residence halls that they had built in the last 10 years. And they had been, you know, they're out in Seattle, they had been very cognizant of their student population and of trying to meet the needs of different types of students. And just to be very transparent, very sustainable, very inclusive, and they wanted to measure their progress. So what we did is we adapted the playbook to look specifically at residential spaces. So to look at everything from the individual unit to the floor, to the residence hall, to the neighborhood community. And we looked at choice and voice. We looked at sense of security. We looked at physiological needs, belonging, all that sort of stuff, and rated all of their buildings. And it's great because they're in the process of designing a new residence hall now. And so they're able to take the information. Some of those really simple things, like something I see come up a lot is signage, just how to get to a place, but then also once you're there, how to use that space. And they have these really great lounges that students just didn't quite understand how to use. Like there was a sign in a lounge that says set the furniture back in, you know, some certain condition when you're done with it. But there was no layout that showed you what that condition was. So then you're like, well, gosh, I'm afraid to move it because I don't want to be accused of being the person that didn't follow the rules. And so some of it was really clear, just like be more explicit about the rules so that people don't, you know, people understand the behavioral expectations and they can kind of relax after that. But then some of it was stuff that they could improve as they were going into their next project. So it was really a great proof of concept for the playbook in general.
What were some specific elements that, I guess maybe like successes that they had of things that they had implemented, or maybe even some failures?
So some of the successes, they were really thoughtful about having the right ratio of study and social space to individual rooms or units. And I think what a lot of institutions have made the mistake over the years as they've increased enrollment and they haven't wanted to build more residence halls, if they can't build them fast enough. So they take common spaces and they turn them into rooms. And then all of a sudden you're in this room with just, you know, nothing but corridors. Once again, it's like that faculty office space again. Everyone shuts their door. You don't know who lives next to you. So they were very specific about having both social spaces and study spaces and having them on every single floor and then having larger common ones within the building so that the students could get together. They also, almost all their residence halls are living learning communities, so the students automatically have something in common. I will say though, like within those study rooms, the proportions were kind of long and awkward, and they had only four-person tables. Like they would have 3 4-person tables. So it accommodated 12 people, but really only 1, 2, or 3 people would go in there at a time, because once one person was in the room, people thought that they shouldn't go in the room, or if they went in the room, they would sit at the next table. So just if you had different size rooms, that different study groups, and if you had different, once again, different types of tables, they could have accommodated study needs. And so what happens is people end up studying in the social spaces, and then they complain that the tables aren't the right height to put their laptop on. So maybe the social space study space ratio was off. Some other things they did that were really good, like they had windows at the end of every single corridor, so there was natural light, and it was really easy. Once you turned the corner, you could see out the window, and you knew exactly where you were going, so you could orient yourself in the building really well. One of the big sort of controversies was two of the buildings, the architects had painted colors on the wall on both the inside and the outside of the wall to be reflective of light. And so basically in the Seattle light, they wanted to make sure everybody had the exact same amount of daylight in their room. And so they made the window sizes different, and they had painted them different colors to sort of, you know, tell this story. However, some of the colors were bright orange and yellow and green, and some of them were blue. And students didn't know the story. And they were like, I don't want a bright orange room, a wall in my room. Mm-hmm. So it's one of those things, like as architects, we're like, oh, this is really great. Like we can have orange walls. But as a student having to live in that space, you're like, do I really want to live with a bright orange wall in my room? So that's an easy fix. They can just paint the walls gray. But that was also a lesson learned, I think, for them, of just getting student feedback before you make these big moves. And I know Rob said that when students heard the story, they were more accepting of it. But without hearing the story, it's just distracting to have an orange wall in your dorm room if you don't like orange.
Yeah. And I can see orange works for some people, but not, definitely not all.
Yeah.
And it's funny hearing you talk about all the things that worked well in the dorms, because I think back to my freshman dorm, which was Kelly Hall at Drexel University. And it was just a big old rectangle. We had no lights at the corridors. We had two-story lounge spaces that I had never been in because they put like 9 boys. No social space because there was people living in all the lounges, and we had like a dirty laundry room downstairs and like a dark room next to it. And that was like the only social space. So I had no place to study. I also was an architect, so I spent most of my time in studio, which thankfully I had another place to go. But I really didn't get a chance to know many people on my floor because there was no, you know, I was walking down the hallway with my little shower caddy and I would see them in passing, and that was about it.
Yeah. And I think as architects, we often forget that we had a home base and that was our desk and our studio, whereas a lot of other students don't have that home base, especially their first or second year. And I think I told you this before, but some of the trends we're seeing in terms of residence halls, more and more students are requesting to live in singles. And then there's really nothing to draw them out of their rooms. And that was one of the other things that UW was talking to us about, that not necessarily this assessment could solve, but that they're seeing more conflict resolution needs earlier and earlier because, you know, especially younger generations communicate through text and through the computer, and they're not used to living with other people. And so it makes me wonder, if we give people singles, are we perpetuating that problem? But then again, you know, there's of course a lot of inclusivity needs that people need singles for. So it's just, yeah, it's one of those conflicts that you just don't quite know which way to go. But it was interesting that it came up, that people were kind of requesting third-party conflict resolution quicker.
Maybe students are more willing to ask for help too, of get that mediator in, but the fact that mediator is needed.
That students can recognize their needs more and they're asking quicker, you know, let's solve this conflict. Yeah, I don't know. So my oldest son right now, he's at William & Mary. He's a first year. And they did something that I was really impressed by. So they have really old, awful dorms. They're in the process of tearing them down one by one and building new ones. But I'm almost afraid they're going to lose something when they build them, because the dorms right now are very tiny. There's basically only 18 people on his half of the floor. And they bring students to school 5 days ahead of time, and they do everything with those 18 other, you know, for him. So for him, it's 17 other boys. And so just then he had this community of people, and their hall is a square and they have a shared bathroom. So it's like they're just this cluster of students. They get to know each other really well. And then you see new dorms and they're really big and they're linear. And it just makes you wonder if we're shortchanging these students, this community, that by building these small groups and small social spaces.
Were a lot of the University of Washington dorms a larger scale?
They were a larger scale. There were 50 students on each side. But once again, they put so much social space into it, and they were so intentional about the students they placed together, that I think it helped a lot. I think a lot of these other residence halls and other campuses are just, they're building bigger because they want to replace spaces really quickly and, you know, give more students the upgraded space. But I don't know. There's something to be said about tiny, I think.
And just to circle back again to University of Washington, did they see any improvements in terms of retention rates or inclusivity, or how people were reporting, maybe feeling like more loyal or connected to other people in their, I don't know, their class?
Yeah. So I can't say specifically, but I do know that they have more students that are asking to live on campus, and they have more students that are asking to live on campus after first year. So it's the student experience is working, and the residential life experience is working, and more students are seeing the value of it. And when, I guess it's hard to say when it comes to a place like Seattle, whether that's the rate of housing or, you know, the community that they've built. But I have to think that at least part of it is the community that they've built there.
That's excellent. As we kind of button this all up, what would you say is one design trend that we should get rid of?
I have to say two. One is the peninsula offices, peninsula desk and faculty and staff offices. And, you know, because I feel so strongly that offices help connect people, I feel like when you have this 120-foot square foot space and you put a desk in the middle of it, you're dividing it in half. You're saying, this is my private space. This is the space that I'm willing to sit down with other people, but this is going to be the barrier. This is the hierarchy. And I don't think that's doing anyone any favors. The other one that I can't wait for us to get rid of is the social stare. And just this idea that when you walk into a building and you see, you're immediately greeted by this big stare that really only caters to extroverts that are very typical in their physical shape and condition. And I feel like everyone else just avoids it. And I just can't wait to see buildings with more variety of public spaces in them than the social stare.
Mm-hmm. What would you say could replace the social stare? Just a flat floor area?
Yeah, I mean, just flat floor areas and flat floor and not just like a singular large flat floor area, but a mix of different types of spaces. It's very important to have that informal space relative to the formal space, and this idea that we want at least 15 to 20% of instructional space to be complemented by informal social spaces. But like those, some of those spaces need to be small and quiet and kind of cocoon people. And some of those spaces should be kind of bigger gathering spaces. And so just having a mix of that versus like this sort of, wow, you know, I have to walk up four stories of stairs, but I can sit on the stair and people can see me. I just, yeah, I'm over it.
Mm-hmm. And then what is one trend that you think we should embrace, or two?
One or two or three.
Okay, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think just thinking about people's basic physiological and biophilic needs and putting those first and just thinking about giving people the ability to control the lights, dim the lights, put shades, giving people the ability to adjust the temperature within a couple of degrees, giving people the chairs and the desk and stuff that they can just tweak them like just enough to match their comfort level. So like the comfort of the larger environment, but also the comfort of the furniture in your individual space. And then I think something that we've been doing really well that we just need to continue to do is having gender inclusive restrooms and having changing tables in restrooms, because that's taking students and saying like, we see you and we value you. We're glad that you're here, just by doing that one, you know, a couple simple things.
Yeah, I would also like to add on like mother's room or lactation room, yes, wellness, yeah, rooms.
All of the above.
Yeah. If you need a good cry, sometimes you just want to close the door and know that no one's going to bother you.
Yeah.
In architecture school, you definitely need a space like that.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure half of it just screamed in the middle of the studio, but yeah. Yeah,
exactly. So Shannon, thank you so much for joining me today. Is there any final note that you want to leave our listeners about just education spaces and your hopes for them in the future?
Just bring people into the conversation and bring a diversity of people into the conversation, and just don't be afraid to ask hard questions and have tough conversations. Get it wrong, follow up, and follow through.
Excellent. Thank you. And if people want to look up your research, where can they find that?
So if you look on SCUP's website, I mean, you can honestly just Google SCUP Shannon Dowling and it will come up. But on the fellowship page, there's a link to all the fellows and all of our research. So mine's not the only one on there. There's a lot of great stuff to read on that page. And it's all free to members and non-members.
Excellent. Okay, I'll put that in the show notes. Great. Thank you so much, Shannon.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of Architect Ed. If you enjoyed the episode, don't forget to share it with your network, leave us a 5-star rating and review, and follow us on social media. Reach out to the podcast directly at architectet.com. That's architectet.com. Join us in 2 weeks for our next episode. See you then.